actually quite interesting because in the early days, we got tons of pushback. People were really unhappy that we were doing, at least a lot of people were fairly unhappy we were carrying out this study, which was always a surprise to me. And a lot of people really thought we would learn nothing because they said, well, you don't have, you know, there's not a case group of with a disease. So therefore it's worthless. You know, groups like, you know, NIH wouldn't fund this thing and, you know, and various, we ended up, you know, getting it off the ground. But when we, but that was kind of the opinion. And so now if we fast forward, we've probably published about, I don't know, maybe 25 or so papers, most of them in Nature subjournals off of what we've learned. And I'll just give a few examples of this and we can dive in on any of these if you'd like. So what are some of the things we learned? So first, one of the elements that became really interesting was we evaluated whether or not people were able to change certain health markers. So let's just take the example of LDL cholesterol. So for LDL cholesterol, which is used for the diagnosis and the administration of statins to millions of people. And as we had people go through these personalized programs, and you just see how well could people by lifestyle intervention lower LDL cholesterol. And we got what a bunch of earlier studies have shown, which is that it's kind of a mixed bag. You see some people change, some people don't, and you get kind of a modest response. But this is where having the data clouds was super interesting because when we then went in and we then took a genetic prediction of your LDL cholesterol, and then we overlaid that onto the responses of people, what we found was very interesting. And that was that if your genome predicted that you would have high LDL cholesterol, and you did, i.e. there wasn't a gap, we saw no ability for those individuals to lower their LDL cholesterol by lifestyle. There was no statistically significant difference before and after. But if your genome predicted that you would have low LDL cholesterol and you had high, i.e. there was a gap, those people were very significantly able to lower their LDL cholesterol with lifestyle, i.e. without drugs. And so what mattered was the gap, the difference between the genetic prediction and your actual value. If the gap exists, there's room for modification and you can do it with lifestyle. And if there isn't, you can't. And why I think that is incredibly important is because modern medicine doesn't use that at all. So every single time in medicine, and this is, you know, and I'm not saying there isn't like a doctor or two maybe that does, but 99%+ doesn't use this. And so if you go into your doctor, you have a high LDL cholesterol and they will give you a statin. And there's no notion of whether you're high because of your genes or not. So this is one of the very basic elements of just bringing genomics into medicine. And it's not only true for LDL cholesterol. If you're trying to raise your HDL cholesterol, so-called good cholesterol, only the top 20% of people on that gap were able to do so. On LDL cholesterol, it was the top 40%. Hemoglobin A1C, I'll give you another example. So that's a diabetes marker. So tons of people are pre-diabetic, but there are polygenic risk scores that you can pull off. So a genetic predictor of hemoglobin A1C. And in this case, we actually know somewhat of a mechanism. So based on that, on your genetics, so hemoglobin A1C, for people that aren't aware, that's a protein, hemoglobin, and then you measure glycation. So these little sugars appear on the protein. And when you do that, and then over time, it represents this aggregate measure of how well you're processing sugar. So that's why it's used for prediabetes and diabetes. Now, a red blood cell circulates on average in the human body for 120 days. But based on genetics, some people are shorter and some people are longer. So some people might circulate for 110, some maybe for 113, or you know, whatever spread. And so what that means is that you either have more or less time for these little glycosylation events to match. Anyway, if you translate that forward, then you again get exactly the same situation, which is a high hemoglobin A1C for someone who has a longer residence time for their red blood cells is less worrisome. If they have it short, then it's more worrisome. And you can predict that from genetics. So again, across all of medicine, one of the big things that I advocate is that we need to be incorporating genetic predictions for all of these biomarkers because it changes the interpretation of them. And you can also use it by analyzing your personal gaps to say, here are all the things that are very likely to change for you because of your genetic predisposition. And we'll start there. So if we're going to design a wellness program for you, we'll start by looking at, you know, not only what you're at risk for, but what are all the things that your body is going to work with you rather than against you so that you make fast progress instead of picking something that maybe you can't make progress on or that's very hard. So that's kind of the notion. So that, anyway, that's one. Mm-hmm. I realized I was giving you a list of all the things we learned. That's one.
Yeah.
That's maybe going to get too long. Microbiome. We learned mm-hmm. a ton about the microbiome. And this is all turned into things that are actionable for your listener. Like we, you know, at Thorne now we have a microbiome test that incorporates a lot of this and so forth. So, you know, it's not just academic. They can, you know, you can use this if you'd like. So, but for microbiome, one of the really fascinating things we looked at was if you looked at the people who went on to lose weight in the AIR-AVAIL program compared to those who didn't. We tried to predict, you know, what would at baseline, you know, so when they first come in, we look at the molecular data. Is there anything that's predictive? And we controlled for BMI because having a high BMI obviously is, you know, having higher, more, you know, more weight on you is a predictor of your, you know, going to go on to be able to lose weight. But after you control for that factor, the metabolites did not predict it. The proteins did not predict it. The 100 clinical labs did not predict it. Only one factor actually predicted it well. And that was the microbiome. And it turned out there are two features in the microbiome that mattered for whether or not people would go on to lose weight. And the first was how fast the microbiome was growing, in particular the Bacteroides in there. And so that makes some sense. Just every calorie you eat is a calorie for you or your microbiome. So if your microbiome is churning and it's taking up a little bit more, you know, maybe that's beneficial to you over the long run. Now, the second thing that mattered more was the type of genes that are in the microbiome. So, for example, if you have genes that are more likely to break down complex carbohydrates that you eat, like let's say you eat a sweet potato or something like that, if you have a microbiome, it will break down part of that. If it has a tendency to break that down into simple sugars, it's harder to lose weight. But if it has a tendency to break that down into short chain fatty acids, it's easier to lose weight. And you can imagine why. Now, because if it's breaking it down to simple sugars, you're going to have a bigger insulin response. That bigger insulin response is going to hit your, you know, your hunger signals more. You'll have cravings following and so forth. So there's many, so the mechanisms here seemed pretty apparent. I will give the caveat that this was an observational study. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a prospective trial. We're hoping to do that still. But the rationale was pretty apparent, and that came out of looking at that study. Another example. So the microbiome, and I should mention, these are all published studies, so you know people can get the references. Another thing we learned was looking at the effect of statins, right? So we talked about LDL cholesterol, right? Lots of people on statins. So these kind of approaches can teach us about drugs as well. So if you look at people on statins and they're trying to lower their LDL cholesterol, it turned out that if you look at the microbiome, so we just clustered people into four different groups, different types of microbiomes. And for one of those types, the lowering of LDL cholesterol in that population is double what it is for everybody else. So it's a massive effect size. It's much larger than any known genetic effect, right? And we already talked about genetic effects. And so that meant that you could predict the efficacy of a statin pretty strongly, quite very strongly, actually, from the microbiome. Conversely, there's a downside to statins, which is that you get a 9% increase in the rate of diabetes for people on statins. And you could take two of the microbiome groups had a much more likely to transition towards diabetes as measured in the markers than were the other groups. So the microbiome could predict both the efficacy of the statin and the likelihood of the major side effect triggering for people, and so forth. We also showed that the microbiome's diversity was predictable from metabolites in the blood, published that in Nature Biotechnology in 2019. We showed that the microbiome diverged, that your microbiome, starting around age 50, your microbiome starts looking less and less like anyone else's microbiome if you stay healthy. Goes away if you get on a bunch of drugs, goes away if you get hospitalized. But that comes up. And that was, we published that in Nature Metabolism, and that got an award from the National Academy of Medicine on the Catalyst Award in Healthy Longevity to help support that work and so forth. Anyway, I could go for about 15 more, but I will stop there to not go too long. But you can just see like so many things that we started to learn off of this data.
Yes. And there's a couple of things I want to go back to. But one thing, while we're talking about the microbiome, can you talk about your test? Because I think it's brilliant, because it solves the thing that I dislike most about getting my microbiome done.
Yes. So this I love to dive into. Yeah, this is one of the areas that is so helpful for health. We've come so far on the science, and then it's really a function of helping people to do this test. So for viewers that haven't done their microbiome, most of the tests require something that most people don't like, which is that you've got to poop on a piece of paper or in a bucket. Depends on the kit that you've got. You got to take a little scoop it up, put it in a vial. Some of the tests require freezing, and I don't know what you keep in your fridge, but if you don't have a test sample fridge at home, maybe you only have a food freezer or something. So, most people don't like that. So there's all these barriers to doing this. So at Thorn, where I'm now chief science officer, basically what we did is we got together and we thought, what was the easiest possible way that we could make it for someone to get, to be able to do this test? And we came up with something called the microbiome wipe, which is exactly what it sounds like. Basically, it is special toilet paper. It's made out of a polymer. And what happens is that, when you do the microbiome test, you wipe like you do every day. So this basically very little behavior change. Then you take the wipe, you drop it into a vial and close it. And when you shake it, within 10 seconds, it will dissolve away. And then you send that back to the lab, and then genetics will come back and you'll get a report. And I'll talk about that in a second. And so what that meant then was that we could, and then we showed that we could get just as good sequencing data off that. And we published that in Frontiers in Immunology last year. So it's all peer reviewed. So that meant that we could let people get access to this. In fact, there was an anecdote that I really loved, which was shared on the Huberman Lab podcast with Sarah Gottfried, was a guest there. And she shared that she was working with an NBA team, and she could never get the NBA team to do the microbiome, even though they thought it was helpful because they didn't like the ick factor with it. And so, but she said when she switched to the wipe that they all did it. And so that was nice to hear. And so that really made a difference, now the flip side is then what happens on the end. And so there's where you can actually get a report. And it's interesting because if you look at the kind of reports that we have at Thorn, they're radically better actually than the microbiome reports that we had at Aravail. It's not a knock on Aravail. It's we're 5 years further in the science. We just know a lot more than we did back then. And the technology on measuring is a lot better. And so some of the things that you can get into are elements that relate to your digestion. So for example, your microbes can make ammonia. And if you have, and you can estimate that from the gene content. And if you're making too much ammonia, that will cause your stomach to be too basic. If you remember back to high school chemistry, and by that making it too basic, then you won't be digesting your food as well. You can see if that's happening. A whole bunch of nutrients, including neurotransmitters, are made, like serotonin, are made in the gut. And so one of the other things you can do is you can evaluate the gene content of your microbiome to see if you're making the nutrients that you would like to see there. A lot of the B vitamins are made there. That, in fact, that's what I was really deficient in last time I measured. So I started supplementing some with a B vitamin. I actually knew that already from my doctor who had done blood tests on me. And so the microbiome That was a year ago. And so then when the microbiome test came through, it confirmed that it was still an issue. But what I hadn't appreciated before taking the microbiome test was that part of the problem was that my microbiome wasn't making things that you would expect to make. So then you can start shifting your microbiome to solve that. And in fact, you can get rid of the need for supplementation in many cases by shifting the microbiome so that you actually have species in there that are making nutrients that you might otherwise be missing. So there's all kinds of things that you can get into like that. So gut dysbiosis, you can look at pathogens, which are disease-causing bacteria, and if they're there. And you can evaluate the effectiveness of your probiotics. A lot of probiotics, you might take and they will pass right through you, but they're not able to engraft and really get, they're not able to compete successfully to, outcompete the bacteria that are already there. And you can see if that's happening. So we monitor for basically all the probiotics that we know about on the market. And you can evaluate that in the test to see whether or not, the probiotic that you're taking is working for you or not. And so forth. There's, many, many, many things that go in there. I think the report's like 20 pages long. So you get a lot of data. There's summaries, there's actionable points, and it will come down to a simple set of recommendations of what we think would make the most difference for improving the health of your gut at the end. But if you want to dive in detail, there's a lot of information that comes out of it.
Interesting. Is it possible? Do we have like species-specific antibiotics? So if you see that you have a strain that you don't want, is it possible to get rid of them without like killing off everything else as well?
It varies in the sense that, we have, there's both narrow antibiotics and broad spectrum antibiotics. We would never recommend broad spectrum antibiotics for someone with like a very serious and infection where you want to do that kind of damage to your microbiome as a trade-off because something is really killing you off. But in general, we would be more inclined towards things like prebiotics. Shifting the food of the microbiome is really important because you have all these species and they're competing against each other. And the food or the prebiotics really define the game, right? The rules of engagement, what's available. Mm-hmm. And so you can do a lot. So introduce more good species, try to outcompete the bad bacteria. Out on a side here too that I think is just really fascinating because the microbiome science is actually teaching us a little bit about how we might think about infection a little differently. And this actually came out of work from a really good friend of mine, Jason Pappin, who's at the University of Virginia. And one of the things that he found and published on, which was really interesting, was looking at a terrible pathogen called C. difficile. And C. diff is one of the most common pathogens that people get. It's a big problem in hospitals and so forth. But a lot of the population has C. diff and is fine. And so the problem is that C. diff secretes these toxins, and those toxins become a problem. So there's all kinds of ways that have gone, and there's actually people that are doing fecal microbiome transplants now that work quite well against C. diff. So we know that by changing the microbiome, you can systemically that you can have this effect on C. diff. But what Jason's group showed, which was really incredible from my standpoint, is that you can go about it a very different way, which is that it appears that C. diff secretes these toxins as part of bacterial warfare. So it has different bacteria that it fights with, basically. And it uses those toxins to kill those other bacteria. Now, in the process, it makes you really sick, but you're not actually the point. You're collateral damage. You're just in the line of fire accidentally. And so what they actually show and are working on now, which is so interesting, is that you might be able to make the microbiome more hospitable to the C. diff. In other words, you get rid of some of the things that they really hate. And you don't trigger the warfare, and therefore it just sits in your gut and does nothing. So that's the kind of thing I bring that up, just because I love counterintuitive ideas. But it's you start getting this whole different toolbox where it's not only bad bacteria kill it. It might be we want this system to operate well. So we need a microbiome that's not at war. That's a very different concept. Than thinking about it from just the the level of that bad species needs to go. And so, and I'm not necessarily arguing for that as, you know, as the approach on C. diff necessarily, but it gives you a sense of how you can think radically differently than we typically do by focusing in on, you know, how is this system behaving and how does that connect to the rest of our bodies, right? Because our high inflammation rates are often driven by the microbiome. Like these things are all densely related. I gave a talk at Caltech late last year and got to talk to, you know, some of the people that run the microbiome center there. We, you know, got into an incredibly fascinating discussion around, you know, all these kind of areas in many different animal model systems where there are very specific species, like almost like a lock and key that they have to have there to stay alive. And this exists all throughout nature in many ways. And it's likely true for us at some level too. There's all these diversity in the microbiome, but there's certain things that we need from our microbiome. And the species are very divergent, but we kind of need that system to carry out certain functions for us to be healthy. And so, you know, there's a lot we still don't understand, but, you know, compared to where we were 5 years ago, I'm light years ahead. And compared to 10 years ago, I'm like the science is moving quickly. And it's now at a state where I feel, you know, very confident that, you know, this is meaningful and useful information for people in their lives. And it's only going to be better, right? 5 years from now, it'll be radically better than it is today.
So in Aravail and Pioneer, you talk about the data cloud and like you collect so many data points. Could it be done in an iterative fashion so that you just look at some of the key data points and then you say, okay, well, this area needs more investigation, and then you investigate those? Or does it have to be like you need everything to be able to build the platform?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So building the density of the data, I think, is incredibly important for discovery because there's so many you know, like when we set this out, we didn't set out to say, oh, we're going to figure out the efficacy of statins and what drives it. Like that wasn't even on our minds. But you, so much just emerges as you go through the data. And, you know, and then once you do that, you know, all the big journals require you to then validate it in another cohort. And a very high fraction of those things have validated. I've been, you know, pleasantly surprised by that. But the question is also back to cost, right? Which I think is kind of what's at the back of people's minds, because it is expensive to run all the tests on all the people, right? And so that is driven by a few things. One is that we think we can bring costs down. I'll talk about that in a moment. But you can get much more granular for individuals. So for example, when we looked at microbiome diversity, one of the things we showed in the 2019 Nature Biotechnology paper was that we could predict half of the variants of a diverse microbiome from a set of 11 metabolites in the blood. So, you know, from a pretty small set of things that need to be created. And so one of the elements there is that you have this huge diversity in the microbiome, but it has to filter down to a relatively finite set of, you know, nutrients and lack of toxins and different things that you want to either see or not see that appear in your bloodstream. So you can create a more targeted, cheaper test as a screen, for example, for potential microbiome problems, and then only go in and do the deep dive if there's an issue. Like you can take it that way. There's a lot more information you get from the microbiome. So in general, I'm a proponent of people doing that. You know, I certainly do it on myself. I've got one down in my bathroom right now. I'll probably do it tomorrow. But you know, so there's like all these different things that you can do. Now, some of the discoveries, though, because we talk about this quite a lot, like we've had some, you know, meetings with groups that are interested in the developing world, for example. And so some of the things that you can learn from these, you know, really high density studies can then be translated in a very, you know, simple, you know, in a very simple kind of way, right? If you identify, you know, prominent deficiencies, difficulties, problems that might exist, you can translate those out, you know, with more limited kinds of measurements.
There are a couple of commercial, but there are a number, I suppose, commercial operations. I mean, there's like, the ones I'm aware of are Inside Tracker and like Levels, Would you see these as kind of, I guess, light versions of what you'd like to do?
Yeah, I think that's right. And in general, I'm, you know, excited about, you know, what I see as emerging as, you know, what I would call the scientific wellness industry. You know, we could call it the precision health industry or what, you know, whatever you want to call it. And I did write an article for Scientific American publication in November, I think, that went through kind of all these companies or a lot of these companies and this emergence of the scientific wellness industry. And I think many of them, everyone's trying to build, or a lot of people are trying to build towards this. And, you know, and I'm grateful for it in the sense that, you know, if you look at traditional healthcare, it's a $4 trillion a year industry in the United States alone, right? And then you can count it out over the world, most of which is very centered on this late stage disease care. So even if you take the entirety of the industry that's being developed around this kind of scientific wellness approach, it's still very small compared to, you know, the world at large. So I'm, you know, I'm happy that these things are pushing forward. And certainly at Thorn, that's, you know, we're a personalized scientific wellness company and, you know, trying to do our part as well to build, you know, out testing platforms and interventions that will matter for people in order to, you know, extend the period which you can live a healthy life. And that's, you know, that's the goal. And I think of many of these efforts. And I talk to a lot of these different groups from time to time, and everyone takes kind of a different tack into there trying to get solutions that will work for people.